Shalom Yehudim, Shalom Bnei Noach, Shalom Goyim. It's the evening of the second day, Kaf Teth Beshvat Parashas Teruma, Tavshin Ayin Vav, the evening of the first day, Sunday, 7 February 2016, webcasting from Unified Israel, at least for today. It is a rare day in our lives here to be as unified over something as we have been since last week. Last Tuesday, three Israeli citizens of the Arab persuasion who also happen to be members of Knesset and receive nice fat paychecks for that from the Israeli taxpayer, if not the Arab taxpayers who notoriously avoid taxes, they paid a visit to the families of 10 murderers of Jews whose corpses remain in IDF possession because the enemy has yet to agree to late-night burials in order to forestall the possibility of mobs of enraged attendees. And when this became known, this visit, Israelis across the political spectrum, including the Palestinian Nationalists of Jewish Extraction and the Meretz Party, were outraged. The three MKs claimed theirs was a humanitarian mission to listen to the pleas of the families who want to give their homicidal offspring a proper Muslim burial. They claim how their children died is not important. Most were slain by Jewish soldiers, police, and civilians in these attempted murders and sometimes successful Jew-killing operations. And it did not help that Mahmoud Abbas, still dishonestly called by the Jerusalem Post the president of the Palestinian Authority, met with the families the next day. You know, Abu Mazen, man of peace, according to Nobel Prize-winning nitwit Shimon Peres, he who has called them shahidin, martyrs. Well, that is to be expected, I suppose, by sober Jews, unlike the delusional Peres. But as I say, across the board in Israel, people were furious at these three Israeli-Arab MKs. The Prime Minister truly represented the people of Israel the next evening when he said that these three do not deserve to sit in the Knesset. And by Saturday night, he had instructed the Attorney General to investigate what the law can do about this. The Knesset has evidently no power to withhold the salaries or to keep these three enemy agents from voting, but they can bar them from participating in debates in the plenum for 6 months, which I think may be more a gift than a punishment given the coarse behavior of the MKs in general. I think what they deserve is to have their citizenship revoked and to be forced from their comfortable homes and made to live in the Gaza Strip. Of course, that's not likely to happen for fear of what the Goyim might do to us. How dare we uproot yet another three ancient Palestinians from their ancient homesteads? Seen from the from a distance, though, Israel itself is very much almost exclusively to blame for this state of affairs in which blatant enemy agents not only can serve in the Knesset, but live here at all. Israel made a huge mistake in 1949 by not driving a massive number of Arabs out of the country behind enemy lines, and we did not do that for the worst of reasons. My late friend, New York newspaper man Sidney Zion, of blessed memory, told me of visiting Israel, probably in the mid-1960s or 50s, spending some time with Moshe Dayan, the IDF's most famous soldier and the firstborn child in the modern kibbutz movement. And in passing on the road, an Arab on his donkey, Dayan said to Sid that without the Arabs like this one, he would not want to live in Israel. Translation, Dayan saw his identity as that of a post-Jew, a post-religious Jew, which really means not a Jew at all. And in fact, in that period, I myself knew Israelis who indignantly insisted they were not Jews, but Israelis. They would argue that Judaism is a religion, and I am not religious. Don't call me a Roman Catholic because I don't believe in Roman Catholicism, and don't call me a Jew because I don't believe in Judaism either. I am an Israeli. There was even in the years surrounding the War of Independence a small clique of artists and other intellectuals here who said they were Canaanites, meaning they were born in this land and were patriotic, like any man is toward his homeland, but religion had nothing to do with it. In fact, in Moshe Dayan's autobiography, the last page is a separate section, very short, in which he relates as an amateur archaeologist that he was, as well as antiquities thief, that he once discovered the tomb of a man who, from all the signs, had died before Avraham Avinu had come from Ur Kasdim. And Dayan said he looked at the bones and thought this man loved this country, his homeland, like any normal man, and so did he. But like him, religion had nothing to do with it. In this, he identified with the pre-Abrahamic Canaanites. And when he said to Sid Zion that he would not want to live in Israel without Arabs, he was saying he didn't want to be exclusively identified with Jews and live in a country with just Jews. Ooh, what a terrible fate. His first wife, Ruth, raised like him in the labor Zionist movement, bragged that in the few years she went to live in London as a girl with her family for some reason, she always played with the Gentile girls, never the Jewish ones. And then their late son, Asi Dayan, of the theater, always bragged he never once set foot in a synagogue, and never would. And from this cesspool of emotion about the central fact of the Jewish people, our religion, came the enlightened views in 1949 not to expel the Arabs, because they wanted a multicultural country, not exclusively a Jewish country. They wanted a country like all others, a modern country, a normal country. Last spring, in the Daily Telegraph, a Dayanesque Israeli icon, novelist Amos Oz, who no longer does PR for the Israelis when abroad at the request of the embassies, because he opposes the government's policies toward the ancient ones. And he said in this interview that the Im Tirtzu group, which named him, of course, was, quote, a monster. We wanted to be like all other nations. We longed for there to be a Hebrew thief and a Hebrew prostitute. And today there are neo-Nazi groups. Perhaps the only difference is that our neo-Nazi groups enjoy the backing of numerous nationalist lawmakers, maybe even racist ones. This is how Amos Oz, soulmate of Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, and Moshe Dayan, looks at Im Tirtzu, neo-Nazis, because it highlights Israeli leftists like himself who identify with the enemy. They wanted to have Hebrew thieves and Hebrew prostitutes. They wanted to be normal. Now, that's what we call progress. What intrigued me is how this man, Amos Oz, in his eighth decade, apparently learned nothing about the Arabs to modify his views of them. They're frozen in time. He dreams the same dream today he did a half century ago. And when he says he wanted Hebrew thieves and Hebrew prostitutes to be like all other nations, he was quoting Chaim Yosef Brenner, who said as much in the 1920s. That's where it comes from. Brenner was a writer who began life as an Orthodox Jew, even a chosid, I think, but at some point he threw off his Yiddishkeit and became a secular Zionist whose dream was to become a normal people, namely, no longer a kingdom of priests, no longer a people that dwells alone, no longer the chosen people, the people that is unique in the world for refusing to work on Saturdays, and so on and so forth. This was the dream of the secular Zionists. They sold themselves as proud Jews who, unlike the timid religionists of the diaspora who were always being massacred and persecuted and never fighting back, they advertised themselves as proud who were going to save the people by restoring the ancient homeland and go live there as a normal people. And thus, because they would then have their own country and not be perceived as an alien people living in another people's country, and because they would no longer call themselves the chosen people, which triggered hatred and resentment, anti-Semitism would evaporate like the morning dew. A residue of this attitude is chronically heard from today's leftists, out of the whining mouths of Tzipi Livni and Yossi Beilin, who are forever criticizing government policy because it will alienate the Gentiles and make them even angrier at us than they are now. Indeed, their soulmate in Washington, Dr. Martin Indyk, the ventriloquist who tells his dummy John Kerry what to say about Israel, had him threatening that if we don't hand over Judea and Samaria, we will be alone, as never before, and branded as an apartheid state, unique on the planet. Fear of not being liked and forced to live alone is the enlightened Israelis' worst nightmare. That way they are returned to the status of Jews. And so since 1949, the Arab population of 150,000 at that time to 10 times that number. And the percentage of the population has risen from 15% to over 20% and is rising, with Israelis still fit to be tied when it comes to thinking about how to treat these people who act the way these three Arab MKs did last week. The horror, the ugliness of paying condolence calls on those who have murdered Jews, just like Jew killers in every generation of our history. In my book, these Arab murderers are on a par with every pagan Roman centurion with a spear, every Christian butcher, every Cossack barbarian, every Nazi stormtrooper. This is why I say the punishment for these three should be loss of citizenship and expulsion from the state. They don't belong here. So this past week has seen Israel unified, as it rarely is. I mean, the ugliness, the ingratitude of these Arab MKs who live well, thanks to the Israeli taxpayer, how dare they pay a condolence call on these savages? These savages who kill us in their cars, with their knives, who pounce on young Jewish police women and old Jewish women as well. On Friday, a 65-year-old grandmother from a kibbutz, I think in the south, went shopping in the ex-Bedouin town of Rahat, outside of Be'er Sheva, was also stabbed by an Arab savage. At the State Department, the spokesman, John Kirby, called on both sides to reduce the level of violence, as if we Jews were also pouncing on Arabs with knives and stabbing them. Don't look now, but this is one of the faces of anti-Semitism in our time. In previous generations, it was up front, without shame, as it is in the Arab and Muslim world today. Today it's disguised with moral equivalence, which basically says we Jews are on the same moral level as these conscienceless brutes, these murderers. For that I say to John Kirby, go to hell. And that's because I'm being polite. In New York, some would say, Chuck Hugh Farley, about the only good thing to come of this past week besides the unity of outrage in Israel is greater clarity, leastwise in my eyes, about these people. They truly are Hamites, descended from Ham, whose name is connected to the greatest sin in the world that brought on the flood, Hamas. Unbridled, conscienceless aggression against other men. Mankind as a whole, at that point, had descended to a life of all against all. Man's inhumanity to man as a way of life. Hashem decides to liquidate his creation in that case and really try again. Only one man and his family deserve to survive the flood. He, his wife, his three sons, and their wives. And I suspect that Ham, whom the Torah singles out for a special introduction for his wickedness, was the one who preserved some quotient of Hamas that survived the flood and infected mankind via him. Since then, it's the poison that we see flowing, I think, in the Arabs who descend from Ham. They appear to be a people with no empathy for other men, and that's not exclusive, by the way, to just us Jews whom they abuse. Look at what they've been doing to themselves in Syria, in Iraq, in my lifetime, in Yemen, in Algeria, in Libya today, in Lebanon. They're monsters to their own people, not just us Jews. It is this cruelty and lack of fellow feeling that marks them, in my mind, as antediluvian Hamites. In our civilization, murdering defenseless Jews as they do, running us over at bus stops, stabbing people in the back, going about their daily lives, is monstrous for civilized people. It bespeaks a lack of fellow feeling, which, by the way, is akin to the clinical definition of the psychopath. They call their violence the armed struggle, and by that they mean murdering unsuspecting, helpless people. In street talk, the Arabs fight dirty. In 1967 and 1956, 1948, 49, Israeli soldiers, outgunned, outmanned, outtanked, outplaned, cleaned their clock on the battlefield. And there are a couple of reasons for that. In the 14th century, the most famous Muslim historian ever, Ibn Khaldun, wrote a 20-volume history of the world in which, in writing of the Arabs, said they were incapable of fighting in classical rank-and-file army formations, like Western armies, and that was so because they lack fellow feeling for their comrades in arms. Very difficult to collaborate with one another. And I would also add that in our time, they're far too backward to be able to handle modern weapons so well as a civilized people like Jews handle them. In 1967, when the IDF overran Sinai, they came across a defense line of, at first glance, artillery pieces, which turned out to be not artillery pieces in the normal sense, but actually the cannon of tanks that had been buried in the sand, turning the weapon into a stationary artillery piece connected to a below-ground pillbox, so to speak. And this is simply crazy. The purpose of a tank is its mobility, its ability to move a big artillery piece around. So for two reasons, the Arabs have always been lousy at being uniformed soldiers, so they lose all the time and resort to retreating into urban streets where tanks cannot go and artillery does not go, and there they can use light weapons in built-up areas. In the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the army melted away and the invading Americans had to fight in the streets everywhere. And when not engaged with enemy soldiers, the Arabs become terrorists. This was the origin of the PLO terror cells. In 1967, the army here once again humiliated the conventional armies of four Arab states, which led to the rise of Fatah and the creation of like a dozen other groups within a year that sprang up, all wanting to murder Jews in terrorist atrocities, to hijack civilian airliners, plant bombs aboard them, plant bombs in supermarkets. The Arabs fight dirty. They cannot defeat a civilized people like us Jews on the battlefield, so they ambush our defenseless civilians, our women, children, babies, old people. And worse, they call this, in my book, these terror atrocities, you'll see, military operations. They cannot fight like real soldiers, so they bushwhack the enemy's civilians and call that the armed struggle, even though there is no struggle. What was the struggle in Rahat on Friday? Plunging a knife in the back of a Jewish grandmother? There's no struggle there. And this is why those three MKs paid condolence calls to the families of these murderers, who Arabs don't see as murderers. That's the big problem. In their eyes, they're soldiers, and they're even heroic martyrs. These Arabs are barbarians because they have no fellow feeling and really no sense, like antediluvian man, that murder is a crime. In a way, they have no sense of murder. All they know is killing one's enemy people. No distinction made between soldiers and non-combatants. For them, war is like a blood feud in which anything goes.
למחול מחולי פיתחת שקי ואתה זה משמחה איי נאי 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 איי נאי 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 שם השם והכונני השם יהיה עוזרי השם אלוהי
Oh.
You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. And those are verses from Psalm 30. So, perhaps it's progress that the Prime Minister has intellectually at least declared that these three Arab MKs don't belong in the Knesset of Israel. And I say the only reason there are any Arabs in the Knesset is Israel's failure to do what should have been done in 1949 and again in 1967, which it did not do because it would have offended Israel's own self-image as an enlightened country. Heaven forfend that the world think of Israelis as conquerors and imperialist aggressors displacing other people. The great second president of the United States, John Adams, said that the American Revolution was made by roughly a third of the colonists. Another third was indifferent or had no opinion, did not know what was right. And the other third was dead set against the revolution. They recognized the abusive treatment from London, but not to the point of wanting to stop being subjects of the British crown. So after the war, there was a significant flight of these Tories out of the new United States of America, either back to England or to Canada or to British possessions in the Caribbean, because they did not want to live in the new experimental republic. There was also a religious dimension to these Tories who believed in the divine right of kings, and therefore a rebellion against the king was a form of blasphemy. After World War II, the Allies ordered 10 million ethnic Germans living in the countries surrounding defeated Germany, that had been overrun by the Nazi war machine, to clear out of these neighboring countries so that Germany could no longer claim their presence was an excuse. They were being oppressed and abused, and that Germany had to rescue. So, 10 million ethnic Germans living in Czechoslovakia and Poland, Denmark, Holland, Switzerland, maybe, I don't know, Italy, were all forced to leave their homes, to leave behind their businesses, their churches, their graveyards where their parents were buried, and go live in the new, smaller, truncated Germany. And this is what should have happened here to the Arabs in 1949 and again in 1967. But again, and not for the first time in Jewish history, the Jewish people did not have the heart to drive out not 10 million, but only 150,000 in 1949, and not 10 million in 1967, but maybe 1 million. On the contrary, in charge of post-war policy toward Judea and Samaria was none other than Moshe Dayan, who believed that Israel, that if Israel is nice to the Arabs here, they will stop hating us and murdering us, as in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, 1960s, before the Six-Day War. Dayan seems to have been largely ignorant of Islam and the history of the Jewish people under Islam, and that attitude survives today among the Israeli left, people that think that Arab hostility is a function of our disrespect for the Ancient Ones, who have as much right to a state in Palestine as we Jews. And when Israel respects their rights and gives them what they demand, they will stop hating us and stop murdering and become friendly neighbors. The Times of Israel site reported today that the Prime Minister is rumored to be worried that before the Muslim agent in the Oval Office leaves office, he will be doing something terrible to us because we have not helped him realize the holy two-state solution for his legacy. So Bibi is asking his cabinet ministers to, quote, approve a series of measures to boost the economy in the West Bank and show Israel's commitment to improving Palestinian lives, close quote. Apparently, and this stems from another flaw in the state the secular Jews created, the Prime Minister thinks that the criticism of Israel for its alleged mistreatment of the Ancient Ones stems from concern for them. So Israel has to show the Goyim that we do care for the welfare of the victims of our national movement. Growing up here in an exclusively Jewish environment, I think, having no experience of Goyim has left Israelis like Bibi still not understanding that the Goyim don't give a rodent's derriere about the phantom Palestinians. What moves them is the age-old need to jubash, to hate and abuse the Jews. The invention of the Palestinians is only this generation's disguised way of doing it. Eve.
אשכחך ירושלים, תשכח ימיני, תדבק לשוני, לך איתי, אם לא אזכרך לי. אשכחך ירושלים, תשכח ימיני, תדבק לשוני, לכי, כי אם לא אזכרך לי.
Okay, that's it for this incredibly rainy day here in Israel. Cold, fog. I'll be back, God willing, on Tuesday. Until then, Laila Tov, Me'eretz Yisrael.